Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Bruce Berner, and I'm a lawyer. Sounds like a 12-step meeting already, doesn't it? And I teach law at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. And I've been here for 2 weeks. This morning and tomorrow morning, I finish up. Talking about a variety of issues in connection with the American criminal justice system. Today what I want to do is to talk about some issues that underlie a lot of different aspects of law, but we mainly think of it in connection with the criminal law. And that is the question that I had posted on the kiosk, crime and punishment. And in particular, we want to look today at what underlies theories of punishment, why we punish, how we punish, indicators on how it is working, if it is working. The particular exercise that I've got here on the blue sheet is precisely what I do with the first period every year with first-year students in criminal law. So these folks have come in criminal law is one of the courses that is offered in the very first semester of law school. I always teach at 8 a.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, primarily because no one else wants to, and because I like to get my classes done early in the day and then get on to my other work. Very often it's the very first class that they've had in law school. And I give them this exercise to start with, because I think it helps them to understand that law school is not a process where first you're given a lot of theory and reason, and then you're asked to apply it to individual problems. What law school is mimicking what the courts do, which is you start with a problem. You start with some human situation that needs addressing. There's no theory that's made ahead of time. The theory comes later. If I would ask these same questions of these students at the end of the semester, they would have all kind of vocabulary to cover up any real reasoning. They would just say, oh, I know what that is, and then they'd give you some legal word that they could slap on it, which we've taught them in the course of the semester. And sometimes learning too much becomes a barrier to thinking instead of helping thinking. And so they'll all say something like, oh, that's easy, that's manslaughter, so that's different. And they think they've answered the question, and all they've done was to slap a label on it. So one of the hardest things to do is, once you've taught people something, to get them from time to time to unpack it. The nice thing about here is they don't even know what clothes they own yet, so they don't have to unpack anything. They can just sort of approach it. What we'll try to do with this problem, then, is to use it as a way of our own starting point. What are we doing with punishment? Consider the following three situations. And do we have maybe one blue sheet?
Can you hand one up?
Here's one left.
Those are the people in high school.
Yes.
Up there. High school. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I shouldn't even try that. Consider the following three situations. X, with the desire to kill A, and for that purpose, shoots at A and kills A. So that's X's situation. And we could slap all kind of labels on that right away, right? We sort of know from watching the news and watching Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law, we know what to call that, but let's kind of leave the labels behind us. Case two, Y, with the desire to kill B, and for that purpose, shoots at B, but misses, and B is unhurt. So we can see immediately how A and B correlate to each other. And then case three, Z, who has no desire to hurt anyone, cleans his gun, does so carelessly, and it discharges, killing C. So we have X, Y, and Z now. And the first question is, among X, Y, and Z, who should be punished the most and why? Who wants to start us off? This is not real law school, so I promise that there'll be no attempt at humiliation, right? And if you don't want any follow-up questions, you tell me to buzz off, all right?
Okay. I would say X and Y should be punished the most.
Okay. Equally.
Equally.
Okay.
Yeah, I once witnessed, I came upon, I lived in Chicago for a number of years, and I was driving up, and these two people were ahead of me, and somehow I got this weird feeling inside, like, if I go ahead, they're going to shoot, throw firecrackers at me. And wouldn't you know it, just in that instant, when I had this gut feeling, kid runs across the street and fires a gun.
Yeah.
This other, and what angered me, I was so angry and so upset, was that just this wanton disregard for life. And so I think why, even that, I mean, with that, because of that motive, that I'm going to kill this other person, this is culpable. Because of that, it's the motive there, with the desire to kill. And even though, unfortunately, in this instance, mm-hmm. this kid missed, but
mm-hmm. so
it was very striking, this whole disregard for life, or I'm going to take your life.
So you would want to punish X and Y equally, and the reason that you assign is motive. Let me just suggest that that's what most of us would call it. We'll probably end up in law calling that intent, and we'll call motive something else. Motive will be what it is that drives people to form the intent. Why do they want to kill, right? But this is an intent. They both have an intent to kill, and because of that, they're equally disrespectful of life. Why should they be treated any differently? They have the precise same sets of motivation and intent. Yeah.
Y didn't accomplish the job. So he'll probably get a different sentence than X.
To be sure, but remember, we're not asking what will he get, but what should he get? In other words, I want us to sort of throw out everything that we know about what might actually happen and get back in what I call a sort of a Lord of the Flies situation where we're kind of making it up as we go along. And you're absolutely right. Yes?
Well, I feel like X and Y should both be punished, but with X, there's a dead person. Even though they may have the same intent or motive, to me, that's far more serious. Someone's dead.
So Y should be punished less? Simply because he was in.
No, I'm not saying that. It's just if I'm going to prioritize X as the highest order.
He makes the point that we're sort of rewarding Y for
being a bad shot.
All of us, our mom or dad, somewhere along the line said, son, daughter, we don't really care what you become, but be the best at what you become. So not only a homicidal maniac, but an inept homicidal maniac, right? And you wonder why we're going to give him a premium for that, right?
Yeah.
But then why shouldn't Z be punished just as equally as X? Because there also is a dead person, and he was careless, and he should know better than keep a bullet in his gun.
Get back at you, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the intent wasn't there.
But still somebody it's a life.
Well, I still say that between X and Y, the damage to the community is far greater with X than Y. Mm-hmm. Because the families affected everything. And to me, that deserves greater punishment.
What kind of damage exists in the community where there's callous disregard for life? I'm going to take your life because you're in an opposite game.
In either case, that's true. But what I'm saying, the damage to the family in the case of X is far greater.
Who's to say that Y isn't going to go out again and this time be successful?
Oh, that's interesting.
They learn from their miss and won't go out again.
I would say that Y still has that pinned up hatred. He missed for whatever reason. He may be inept, but he's probably going to go out and try to kill someone else again. X is already satisfied.
But if we do that, we say somebody has an intent to do something. How are we ever going to improve those kinds of things all over the place?
Because he pulled the trigger.
And I think we have to have laws that do where we can know where categorize things, or we're going to have anybody can make the decision when all your intent was.
Well, that's a very important point, and we of course get to that later in the semester, and that is we get to everything later in the semester. This is the first day, right? So everything we're going to get to later. But the wonderful thing about that point is that the law never undertakes to punish mere intention for a lot of reasons. Usually, we can't find out what it is. Secondly, there are a lot of autonomy issues, a lot of political things. You're entitled to think whatever you want. But in none of these cases do we have just intent, right? We have intent then coupled with action in all three cases, enough action that the law could probably take some response. The first two are shooting on purpose. The second is engaging in careless or negligent behavior. So in all cases, we have some action beyond mere intention, right?
About should bees.
Uh-huh.
Not what will happen.
Right, that's right.
And if I were bee, I would want, and we're not talking about the victim at all, but it's bee has been, someone tried to kill me.
Right. Wonderful. What if you're bee? How do you react to all of this? And you made an interesting point before that pent-up anger is still there and why he hasn't succeeded. And it isn't as if usually in homicide where people have an undifferentiated anger or rage to sort of kill indiscriminately. Usually their anger is focused on a particular individual or individuals. So that in a case where if I were B, I would be really nervous. Mm-hmm. Because there's someone out there who has sufficient hatred for me that I become a target for that person. So there's a strong sense in which Y is a more dangerous person now in the future than X is. Because the person that X had this awful sort of hatred for is dead. And so now we get into some interesting questions of, are we worried about what's going to happen in the future, or are we worried about what already happened in the past? Which of those two things are we going to pay attention to? So we already have a couple of pieces of tension going. Yes?
So that, for me, begs the question, what's the purpose of the punishment? Is it to protect society, or is it to deter future criminal activity, which is what I hear all the time in the news, or is it to punish the specific person for this specific action?
Huh.
I don't have the answer, but I see these various reasons people want to punish other people.
Yeah, but you see what the right question is. And the right question is, and it often takes law students a half hour to get anywhere near it. They always talk about they want to punish, and they never stop to say, wouldn't it have been better if we had first started by understanding why we want to punish? What are we trying to do with it? If we understand what the purposes of it are, then it's going to be a little bit easier to apply it. But of course, that's precisely why I don't want to tell them ahead of time, right? I want them to sort of come to that, because things that people come to by trial and error become more positive for them and more permanent for them than things that they just read in a book. But they're, now, let's go back to this problem here. One tension that we have going is in terms of if we were to check these things off and make kind of a matrix of them, two things that we've looked at, intent is one, and harm is the other. That was your point, that there's a dead person in some of these cases, and in others there isn't. And so what we have is that in X's case, we have both the intention and the harm. In Y's case, we have the intention without the harm. And in Z's case, we have the harm without the intention. Right? Which is more important to you? What went on inside the person's head in terms of forming an intention to kill? Or whether or not there was a death? Or are they both important for different reasons?
I think if I were the parent of the person who was dead, then the harm would be more important than the intention. Because it would affect me personally.
Huh.
I hear that all the time. I mean, you hear that all the time. I want this person punished because my child is dead. He deserves to be punished.
Yeah, and of course it's always, I'm going to close this for a minute for the last One of the problems here is that in almost all of these stories in criminal law, we almost immediately identify with one of the parties, and we begin to see it from their standpoint. And so we would say, if I were the parent of the dead sea here, but the dead sea, where'd that come from? If I were the parent of that dead person, I would react in a particular way, and it may be different from the way that the general members of the public would react. And if we get too hung up saying, how would I write this as the parent of C, and now we write the law to make ourselves real happy when we're the parent of C, the next thing we know, the real case that comes along, we're the parent of Z, who did the careless shooting. And then we begin to see differently, was an accident. Yes, they're dead, but why is this law saying we have to go to jail for 20 years over an accident? Why do we want to ruin two lives? And so the problem for the criminal law is to sort of come at this, in a sense, blind to where we're going to find ourselves in the process. Whenever we, for example, have an argument about the death penalty, which, and maybe we'll get into that, but later, okay, because that's got all of its own things. People will always say, well, if this were my kid that were killed, I'd want blah, blah, blah. And someone else would say, well, if it was my kid that did the killing, I'm not so sure. Yeah, so that's kind of just the sort of happenstance of where we are in the process. But I think you're right. How about asking the question this way? What if these are these little stories are the lead story on three consecutive days in your local newspaper? And so you pick them up and you read this account, and of course now these people have names. They're not just X, Y, and Z. Right? A friend of mine who's not a lawyer says lawyers always use hypotheticals that have just letters of the alphabet so that they learn not to confuse their clients with real people. fair enough up to a point, right? So you would read these stories, they have real names, very often you would know the people. And one question is, how do you feel on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday? Which day do you feel the worst? And which day, more importantly, do you feel the second worst? Because I think pretty clearly, Monday's the worst. Because we have both the full amount of harm, and we have someone who did it intentionally. So there's just more in the air. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it would get down into your D's. You know, if the person who was killed was the drug dealer and the deal went bad and all that, I might not. Mm. You know, I might think, gee, that's too bad. A human life is lost. But I might put the paper down. Okay. If it was, you know, some of the others there, I'd be really upset.
Mm-hmm. But maybe that's also a way to get rid of somebody that we'd like to get rid of without giving him. I mean, I would too.
Yeah. I just put the paper down. I probably wouldn't think about it again, but it was some other person. And then it would bother me for a while.
Would you be leaving Part D alone, which gets into another aspect of who the victim is, right? Are you more upset on Tuesday or Wednesday?
Wednesday,
there's a death.
Yeah.
Wednesday, there's another person in the community who is dead. Nobody is dead in Tuesday's paper, huh?
Yeah, you're right. I will go with Wednesday because that is senseless, but that's very sad. But I know of a case in our community, and I'm friends with, we have a small community, where a young kid, about 15, was showing his friend his father's service revolver, who's a policeman. Shouldn't have been, obviously. It discharged. And I know that child fairly well from the time he was a little kid. There was no intent whatsoever. Fortunately, the other kid was not killed, but he was injured and lost part of a lung. But, you know, he could have just as easily been killed. So, you know, everybody involved. There was no intent there. There, you know, there's no doubt in anybody's mind there was no intent.
And if the person would have been unfortunate enough there to actually produce the death, my guess is you would not want to react with as heavy a punishment as you would in Y's case.
Well, he's punishing himself so badly, you know, several years ago, and he's still is in therapy. He has a lot of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Very guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that adds another very important component, and that is that the criminal law is not the only system that punishes this stuff when it happens. It gets punished in a variety of different ways. And it may, in fact, be that we can trace the development of the criminal law in some ways to a breakdown in these other systems that used to exact the punishment. So when the culture or the community or the church or the group that always used to make people behave, when that started to break down and people sort of left that and lost their identity with that, then for the first time, so we needed a formal structure to deal with that. This particular problem here, the problem of intent and harm, is usually referred to in these terms. And that is, does the law respond based on the magnitude of the harm or on the magnitude of the wrong? We would say that in Y's situation, the action has more wrong attached to it, more moral blameworthiness, because he's intending to kill. So that's a more evil intention than Z, who is merely being careless with a firearm. If we were going to have the punishment depend purely on the wrong, then we would end up where we started. That is, X and Y would be punished exactly the same because the moral wrong there appears to be the same, and that is unless we get more facts here. And Z would be punished less, if at all. If we were going to punish on the basis of harm, then X and Z would be equal. Y would drop out, although not entirely, because there's some harm in being shot at, even if you're not killed, right? So there's a certain amount of physical and non-physical harm that occurs in those cases, but nothing like that. Now, what we basically do is when we have civil cases where the parties are suing each other, we're more concerned with this one. That is, the amount that you recover in a tort case is more likely to be a function of what your damage is than of how wrong the other person is. On the criminal side, we are more concerned with the gravity of the moral wrong than we are with the amount of harm. But in each of those systems, we are finally concerned with both. What we could say is that the civil side worries more about the harm, but they still require proof that the defendant did something wrong, that the defendant was at least negligent, that at least had some amount of fault. We will, however, see some cases where on the civil side you don't have to have any fault at all. There are some sort of strict liability theories, so that manufacturers, for example, of certain kind of defective products may pay even if they couldn't have avoided it. People who use blasting equipment will pay for damage, even though none of that was their fault. People who keep wild animals, if the wild animals do damage, they pay for that damage, even though they took every possible precaution. So sometimes on the civil side, we only worry about the harm and wrong drops out, but usually wrong is in there at the level of what we call negligence. And on the criminal side, even though we worry most about the wrong, we worry in part about the amount of harm, too. If we take X and Y, we know that the criminal law punishes X more seriously than Y. And then part of the question is why is that, right? So we'll get to that.
But after your question,
before
you talk about civil and criminal,
uh-huh.
Well, no, I'm on a jury. Is somebody going to brief me and tell me what's important in civil or criminal law?
Yes, the man or woman in the room will give you a long explication on what the law is and what your job as a juror is. when you first sit, you'll get a sort of a refresher course or a beginning course from the judge, of pretrial instructions, the kind of things to listen for, maybe predicting this is this kind of case. The judge will tell you what kind of case you're going to have, right, and what some of the issues might be. Part of the reason for doing that is we need to make sure that you don't know any of these people in the case, or that there's not something about you or your history or your job which would bias you in a very unusual way about this case, right? Maybe it's a case of alleged police brutality and you've been 40 years on a police force somewhere, okay? Well, we need to tell the jurors enough about the case, A, so we can see if there's a problem with them, with their sitting on this case, and B, then, to instruct you and educate you about the kind of case you're going to hear. Then, of course, the lawyers are going to give you opening arguments in which they're going to outline their theories of the case. Before you deliberate, you will be given a set of final instructions by the judge, and the judge will give you what all the law is, and basically those are in this pattern. If you find this, this, and this, then you may give this result. If you don't find this, this, and this, but you find this and this, then you may give this result, and if you don't find any of this, then you give this result, which is to acquit in a criminal case.
How about if I don't believe in the law as the judge states, am I a criminal for voting the other way?
No. For one thing, we have a... first of all, we're going to try to find that out before we let you sit. Okay. And part of the voir dire of the jury is to see if they have a particular problem with the law. In about five states, we have what's called the principle of jury nullification, and it is actually what we call de jure. That is, it is actually written into the law that the jury is the judge of both the facts and the law. And if you don't like the law, then you can, in effect, overrule. And we specifically instruct the jury in those states that they have this power.
Wow.
In most states, we don't specifically tell the jury that. But the jury has de facto nullification power, because once the jury speaks, what happens next? The answer is, they go home. The jury is a totally irresponsible agency. Once it decides it, that's it. You can't challenge it. You can't get behind it. In most states, you're not allowed to talk to the jurors afterwards about what they decided and why. So in all states, they have the brute power. If they don't like the law, or if they don't like the prosecutor, or in some criminal cases, homicide cases, if they don't like the deceased, they may just vote, yeah. What do you think of that, judge? And the judge goes, oof. You know, there are some cases where the judge can take the jury verdict and change it. But in a criminal case, if the jury says not guilty, the judge can't change it, because there's a constitutional right involved there, and that is a constitutional right to have the jury make that call. D. Oh, well, let's start with C. How much exactly should Y be punished? I think we've kind of sorted through A and B, who should be punished the most, who should be punished the least. I think the answer there, by the way, is X should be punished the most. That's where most people come. And whether Y or Z is second is going to depend on whether you put more weight on wrong or more weight on harm. Most people are going to put more weight on wrong. That is, most people are going to have an instinct, at least, to punish Y at a level above Z. So most people are going to want to punish these in the sequence X, Y, Z, although you can see that some of the other combinations are arguable, right? X and Y together is an arguable combination. X, Z, Y is an arguable sequence. XYZ is usually where we end up. How much exactly should Y be punished? Now we can stick a label on this one, right? What's the label for Y? What do we call what Y did there? No, nobody's dead in Y's case. Attempted murder, right? That's attempted murder is the common vocabulary for that crime. What do you think?
A long suspended sentence.
Okay.
Okay,
there may still be some debate about that. The long suspend the whole thing?
Well, you know, if he gets in trouble again, it's only 15 years or something.
Okay.
That's what I meant. Okay. Maybe I expressed it wrong.
So we have a long suspended sentence.
Is that like probation then?
I gather that that's sort of an immediate probation, but if anything else happens, then you make the suspended sentence real long, so he knows if I make a mistake again, this huge thing comes down, right?
Give him a time in jail, a period of time with extensive anger and counseling.
Okay, a lot of counseling. How long?
Oh. However long it takes to get rid of it.
Oh, an indeterminate sentence? That is, we'll put you in there until you get better?
No, I don't know. I'll give you a period of time.
Okay.
A year.
What?
Okay.
How important is it in how the, how Y responds in the trial?
Wonderful question. In other words, first of all, who does the sentencing? And secondly, what does the person who does the sentencing get to take into account? What does the law say they may take into account? What might they take into account whether the law says it or not? In other words, how much discretion are they given in deciding how long this will be?
Yeah. Are they remorseful?
Well, remorse, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Are they remorseful? Do they show some signs of rehabilitation, you know, that they could be?
Mm-hmm.
What would you base that on?
There
are some people who have no, I mean, they appear to have no conscience, or they appear to.
But that's not always. Some great sociopaths are wonderful actors.
Well, absolutely. They're the
yeah,
best.
That's right.
They're the best.
An expert witness.
I call
they
it
find
yeah, well, I would go.
Because one of the things that gets in the way of acting is fear, and they have none, right?
Right.
Yeah. So they can sell it. In fact, there's a lot of debate about this in the scientific community, but it appears at least that a sociopath can beat the polygraph. That is, that the sociopath, this ability to hide it is so deep, it even goes all the way down to physiological levels, and they don't sweat, and they don't. Their heart rate doesn't increase when they lie, and all kind of other things that happens to the ordinary person. So they're not just acting; they really are, sort of at that level. Yes.
You take into account past record.
Sure. Yeah, a whole list of things that we take into account in sentencing that we don't take into account when the legislature sets the penalty for attempted murder. The way it has traditionally worked in this country, at least, is that we pick a particular crime, let's say attempted murder, and the legislature will, by statute, tell us what the penalty is. Sometimes that's very specific. It might be a very small range, 15 to 20 years. Boom. And then the judge decides within that. The first half of the 20th century was characterized in most states by very, very indeterminate sort of things like 0 to 30 years. Well, when you set a penalty of 0 to 30 years, what you're really saying is we are out of the sentencing business and the judge is into the sentencing business. What happened in the second half of the 20th century is a move to get rid of those highly discretionary calls, bring the ranges way down. In other words, the legislatures were taking back the power to punish, leaving judges very little room to wiggle. And now some of you who, and I don't know, do you do any federal work?
Some, yeah.
Yeah, at the federal work, we have a thing called the Federal Sentencing Guidelines, which is this huge manual you have to open up and study over. A federal judge who's a friend of mine says it used to be called Doing Justice, now it's called Doing Algebra. Right? Because you go through this book, and if the offense is one of these classifications, then you add a point for this, and you subtract a half a point for this, and of course it includes things like prior offenses, indications of remorsefulness, all of these things. But the judge doesn't have any discretion at all. The judge just has to go through this book and find out what each of these things is worth. So it's a very, very determinate, very determinate system. Yes, sir?
I thought there was a federal statute that had a deal like this, assault with a firearm, 5 yards.
Yeah, it will start with a base sentence.
Not less than 5 years.
Yeah.
Period.
Oh, there's a million federal statutes.
Yeah,
right, for all kind of different things.
The 1968.
Yeah, but we don't have enough facts. We don't have enough facts here to indicate any federal jurisdiction at all. Yeah. There's nothing about this that suggests because it's not a federal crime to kill somebody.
Yeah.
Okay. Federal crimes are much more particular. There has to be some federal interest involved. It would be a crime, for example, to kill a federal officer.
Yeah.
Or a candidate for federal office. So we may, in some of these homicide cases, get federal jurisdiction, but not too often. All right. What I mentioned in the advertisement for this is that whatever a penalty for particular misconduct there is, the American penalty for that tends to always be the highest worldwide. Okay, for similar misconduct, our instinct seems to be more punishment is better. I mean, that's just part of what we've sort of sold ourselves on. You wanted to talk a little bit about D. In X's case, should any of the following change the punishment? A, the victim now, this is the deceased, was a police officer, was a 5-year-old child, was X's spouse, was a creep, or X was white, A is black. And X killed A because he hates black people. Do any of those things matter to you in terms of how much punishment? That is, the identification of either the victim or the identification of a particular motive that underlies the intention.
I'd say it should be a greater punishment for killing a police officer than just about anything.
Yeah, why?
To discourage people shooting at the police.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've got a tough job.
Yeah, and so we get the argument there is sort of additional protection for people who tend to be sort of chronic targets. Okay, and so now the penalty looks not so much as punishment as it does a device to protect a particular class of persons who are always in a dangerous situation. There are a lot of states who increase the punishment when the victim is a child, right? Because of the sense that the victim is defenseless, right? And when the victim is defenseless, that seems a little worse to us, that you should do that. Many states now, as to number 5 there, are adding a lot of penalty for these so-called hate crimes. If racial animus appears to be what is driving it, the penalty is increased. Let's look at this a different way. And I think what you're going to notice is that you've, in your conversation, really hit, in one way or another, all of the classic reasons that are given for punishing. And let's go through what some of them are. The first one, the very first one, what was expiation or expulsion, which simply meant when someone did something you didn't like, you threw them out. You exiled them from the community. You got them out of here. Right? What's capital punishment at Holden Village for staff?
First bus out.
And VO, next bus out, right? Why? Because the system here doesn't have the apparatus to do long-term sort of work with people. Just out. You don't understand our rules, you're out. Well, early on that worked. Our problem is, for a variety of reasons, it doesn't work. I've often wondered, so you get rid of them. You're sending them somewhere, right? we look at crime statistics, and you find the most interesting thing. If you get a very, very rough prosecutor in a particular county and add on extra police to really drive crime down, then you look at the numbers, you'll find out that in that county you did drive crime down. Where'd you drive it? To the next county, somewhere else. In other words, we don't really so much reduce crime by that kind. We can reduce crime in other ways, but just by heavier enforcement, we don't reduce it, we just move it. Right? We move it to the next place. We live in Indiana in a county called Porter County. right next to is a county called Lake County, which has Gary, Hammond, East Chicago, all the steel mills, a very different kind of population, high population centers, big cities. And at least twice a year, someone will get up in Porter County, a defendant, and will say, "Judge, I'm sorry. When I did this, I thought I was in Lake County." Well, you know, it's the same law. It's all Indiana. But what they're saying is, we know what the caseload looks like over there. We know there are so many cases they can't afford to prosecute the small stuff. Theft, are you kidding? They can't even get all the robberies tried over in Lake County, so I thought I was stealing over there. Now I'm in Porter County. There's going to be a jury. There's going to be lawyers. Everybody's going to take it seriously, etc.
So when you read in the newspaper that crime statistics are going down, or...
They are going down, yeah.
Or that better, more police does bring it down. You need to be a little suspect of that. Statistic.
That's right. The crime reduction, which is achieved purely as a function of throwing a lot more traditional law enforcement in a particular place, will tend to drive it down there, but very often will simply move it somewhere else.
So if you looked at the figures around it, would that be an indication?
Yes. Yes. Usually you can see that there. All right. Now we'll get into probably the two most. The two leading theories now today, in at least in American criminal justice, are what we'll call retribution. And retribution is kind of a kinder word for revenge. And it actually theoretically includes a little more than revenge. First of all, it's institutionalized revenge, right? It's collectivized revenge. And secondly, it carries with it some notion that when a criminal offends, the criminal hurts the whole community. There is a hurt there. And it's not a hurt that's felt just by the victim. The hurt that is felt just by the victim gets vindicated in a civil case. Okay? And so if the defendant kills someone, there's both a civil suit and a criminal suit. The civil suit is so the victim can be recompensed for that particular loss. Right? Did you wonder why there were two trials in OJ's case? Did you think it was just because everybody thought the first one came out wrong? No. It was because there were two very different classes of hurt going on there. One to the family of the persons who were killed, and one to the whole community who felt wrong. And of course, those cases came out differently, but then there are different standards of proof in criminal cases and civil cases. That's why I asked you, how did you feel when you read the paper Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday? Because the amount of hurt that you feel begins to drive how much you want to punish. Immanuel Kant said that there was almost like an algebra here, that punishment was to make things right again. They're askew. They're out of balance. And until the punishment is meted out and delivered, we feel cockeyed, right? In Ghana, here's an interesting one. What do we do in this country if we're about to try someone for murder and then that person dies? Do we have a trial?
No.
They do in many cultures. In Ghanaian cultures, they do. Because until we have the trial, things are out of balance. Things aren't right. It's not just what do we do with him, it's what do we do for us? What kind of procedure do we go through so that we're whole again? So there's a kind of a brokenness that the system is understood as healing. And then deterrence, or prevention, and these words are used in the literature, they don't mean exactly the same thing, they're not quite interchangeable, but it's the same idea. That is, one of the purposes for punishment is to affect what will happen in the future. And we divide deterrence into special deterrence and general deterrence. Special deterrence means the effect that punishment has on the person punished. That is, when you punish someone, what effect does it have on them? How does it change their behavior? General deterrence means what effect does our learning that someone else was punished have on our behavior? What's the general effect? So when someone is sent to prison for 10 years for overfilling their coffee cup. Not that that would happen. And I read about it, I'm going about halfway, and I don't want to push it beyond that, right? It will have a certain effect. Now, that depends on a number of things. It depends on my learning about the punishment, right? And it depends on my desire to overfill my coffee cup. I mean, if I have some sort of a phobia where I have to overfill it, that deterrent may not be strong enough. But we always talk about deterrents as how do they work at the margins. There will always be people who you can't deter from doing certain things because what propels them to do it is more powerful than the worst thing you can threaten them with. But there's always people at the margins. Right, so when you increase the arson penalty from 10 years to 12 years, at least theoretically, there's a margin of people who say, well, 10 was one thing, but come on, 12 were different. Right? Now, it's hard for us to believe that. And the interesting thing is arson is one of the oddest crimes because it appears to be almost a kind of crime where it doesn't matter what the penalty is, you don't raise or lower the amount of arson. Now, I'm not talking about arson for profit. I'm not talking about businesses that burn down for insurance purposes. I'm talking about people who burn buildings just for the fun of it. It appears that that's so tied up with all kind of violence and sort of sexual perversion things that the person just can't resist it no matter what you threaten the person with. The other problem, of course, with deterrence is that many people who commit crimes simply don't think they'll be caught. And if you don't think you'll be caught, you can't affect them by raising the punishment. Okay? That's one of the reasons, by the way, why there's an effort all the time to persuade people that people get caught more often than they really do. When I was little, there was a guy who would come on TV and say this. My mother and father always said this to me, crime doesn't pay. Okay? Let me tell you something. Crime pays big. Okay? That's the reality. But, you know, we don't want to be saying that because that's seen as weakening the deterrent. So we carry the reality on the one hand that crime pays big, but the rhetoric has to be that crime doesn't pay. The interesting thing about deterrence is it comes up a lot in the death penalty arguments, right? Should we have the death penalty? And then they say, well, there's a lot of literature out there, and the literature is unclear about whether the death penalty deters crime. Yeah, and that's true. Although, if you mean special deterrence, it's worked every time. No one has committed a crime after they've been the recipient of the death penalty. Right? It just doesn't happen.
If it's actually carried out.
Yeah, it's carried out. Once it's carried out, they don't commit any more crimes. But what we're talking about in that debate is what effect is it having on the others? And I've always said, if you want to be in favor of the death penalty, I'm not. But I concede that you can have a reasonable argument for it. I mean, I think that's a wonderful debate. Both sides can be very reasonable there. But I always say to the proponents, if you really want the death penalty and you really want it because you say it's for deterrence. See, I really think they want it because this is how much retribution they feel and they need to discharge that. But if you really want to make the claim that it's for deterrence, then I say, fine, put it on TV. Because if it's going to act as a general deterrent to others, they got to see it. Well, they're a little afraid of that. And you can kind of guess why the pro-death penalty forces are afraid of having us actually see what delivery of the death penalty looks like. Although I don't even know about that. I mean, when you look at your local tape store, ask them what are the biggest moving tapes in your local tape store. Ask them. They'll tell you. It's the really violent stuff, even the snuff film stuff that's illegal in many states to even show. People want to see this. So I don't know. Maybe this death penalty thing isn't quite right.
Bruce? Why is why are our penalties higher than the rest of the world?
Well, first of all, could I ask you that a follow-up? Because I would challenge where you come with that. My experience has been, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
Why do you say that?
I say which?
Try to be a drug smuggler in Singapore. Commit a crime in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
I don't think we are, what you say.
Well, It's certainly true that there are individual kind of crimes with which other cultures deal with way more harshly than we do. Some of them are for economic reasons. Some of them are for cultural reasons. You're absolutely right. I am not saying that for every crime we're highest. But what I'm saying is as a general pattern, if you take across cultural lines a series of, say, 10 crimes, burglary, and we'll put drugs in there, murder, all these things, you will see that in the majority of those, whoever you put us up against, we deliver a higher penalty. You will find some, though, where you will find these things like, don't get caught with marijuana in Turkey. Right? Don't get caught with marijuana in Turkey because, but that's a different sort of problem. A lot of that is economic and a lot of that is cultural. Right? But what I'm saying is, by and large, how many countries have the death penalty?
Five or six.
Yeah. Who are they?
But if you look at population-wise, a vast percentage of the world does. China has the death penalty. They have half the population of the world almost.
Yeah. China, America, South Africa. That's the list.
No. Saudi Arabia does. Singapore does.
Good.
Aren't you ignoring South America?
Huh?
You're ignoring South America. All of it.
No, most of them don't have institutionalized death penalty for criminals.
But, well,
it happens, but it's just not happening lawfully.
Maybe it's a shame to you.
Yeah. Your question, Dick,
was if we believe that we have more severe penalties than most of the rest of the world, why is that true?
Great question.
Well, one reason might be that we're trying to increase the deterrent effect. I studied this a few years ago, and it seemed like the deterrent, at least general deterrence, depended on three things. How certain it was you're going to be caught, how quickly you're going to be punished, and how severely you're going to be punished. And you put all those three things together, if you're certain to be caught, punished quickly, and punished severely, you're not going to do it.
Right.
But the fact is, in America, property crimes, maybe one out of 25 is ever cleared. So, I mean, it's
right.
You have a pretty good chance of getting away with a property crime. If you do get caught, it's going to be months before you end up going to trial.
Right.
So the legislature realizes that our police are not clearing most crimes. That takes a long time to go to trial. They can't do anything about that. So what do? They jack up the penalty as high as possible to try to somehow try to make the deterrent effect as high as possible. And it doesn't seem to work. That seems to me would make more sense from purely public policy aside, to quadruple the amount of police, or 10 times the amount of police, so we would catch every criminal. Now that would have other downsides, and we'd turn them into a police.
And you wouldn't get that. It's diminishing returns. You don't by quadrupling the police solve all the crimes.
No, but you solve a lot more, and there'd be a greater deterrent effect. But the effect on society. Would be something we wouldn't want. Right. So there's a certain amount of crime we've got to put up with.
Yeah, let me suggest a couple of things, just as possibilities for why we're punishing more. First of all, there is a part of what was said there, that is, there's a lot of them we're not catching. And since we know there's a lot of them we don't catch, let's take it out on the ones we do catch. There's a little bit of that. If you know that a lot of people are getting away with a particular thing, when you find the one that you can catch, usually you can't catch them, but you got them, boy, you want to make an example out of this person, right? And really sock it to them, both to educate the rest of them, and because you're frustrated because you can't catch most of them. That's one of the things. I think secondly, in this culture, we punish more because the punishment that the criminal justice system meets out may be the only punishment we think they're going to get. We don't think they're going to get punished by their community, by their church groups, by others. They're not going to be shunned. They're not going to be driven underground. They're, in fact, going to be celebrated in some places. So I think there's some of that we see this as the only punishment. I also think, and this is where now I'm going to get into a big debate, I also think that we've been oversold on the lie that more punishment will simply drive down crime. I think the problem is 100 times more complex than if you have more punishment, you'll get less crime. even get instances where we can show statistically it goes the other way around. When you add to the punishment, there's more crime. It's a little bit like the economic problem where when you raise the price of goods, for certain kind of goods, you raise the demand.
Bruce, I wanted to second that too. In the community I live in, well, in this state we've got the three strikes law. We're putting people away, sometimes people who haven't committed that series of crimes for life.
Right.
And so what we're doing, we're building more and more prisons in the county I live in. I think for public works, that's been the biggest thing in the county.
Right.
They built a new county jail, new city jail, and more recently, a jail for older people. Yeah. Well, all of, because they have to keep these people for life. Mm-hmm. All the studies show that once you get above, 50 years age, somewhere in there, the incidence of recidivism is about nil.
Right.
So what are we doing? We're spending huge, I look at it just in terms of where we invest our money, we're spending huge amounts of money for prisons, yet the young children who are most at risk in our society, who may become the future criminals, we have no resources for them. So to me, there's another part to this picture is how we allocate our resources within society.
Big part to that picture, my guess is over the next 20 years, the biggest single change we're going to see in criminal justice is a slow but sure move to community corrections. To all of the tenets of the community corrections ideas, that is less reliance on the Auburn-style warehousing of people in a building and more attempts to deal with them in different ways. That, I think, is going to happen because we're going to get a coalition of people who think that's just the way to go, that makes more sense, with the fiscal conservatives who are going to see that in the long run it will be cheaper. And that's a pretty powerful coalition if you can sort of get the liberal social justice people who have been saying this stuff for 30 years together with fiscal conservatives who now see jails cost too much. That's a pretty powerful group. And if they don't tear themselves to pieces first, they may actually get some.
Like this gentleman back here said, too, sometimes it takes so long to get through the criminal system that perhaps we need to look at that speed it up with crimes that are more, doing things that are more in the community, service projects or, something to take care of the smaller crimes.
One thing that the statistics show, and it's so hard to get good crime statistics from anywhere, because first of all, what percentage of the crime do we never learn about? And the answer is, if you know that, you can't know that because we never learned about it, right? But we suspect that we're learning about less than half of the incidents that are truly criminal. But one thing you'll notice when you do get good statistics is this: the rapidity of the punishment is 10 times more powerful than the amount of the punishment.
The speed of the punishment.
The quicker you react, if you react quick, you can react with a much less kind of punch. Don't touch that. Well, it didn't hurt, but it was so fast after I touched it that I'm not touching it again, right? Better that than give me a 3-year-old trial with a bunch of appeals and then hit me with a hammer on the foot. You know, that one. Right when I touch it, don't do it. So we have to find ways to speed it up, and we are finding ways to speed it up. We're diverting a lot.
Be more clever and diverting, punishment.
Right.
Do I understand that in England now the speed of the trial and punishment is much faster than here?
Yes. But it's much shorter, too.
Well, why is that? That's if you worked it.
I can't give it to you in a few words. I want to 30 seconds to give you one more word to think of. There's a whole lot of other things that will go on this list, things like education. But let's just talk for 30 seconds about rehabilitation. That is sometimes called reformation or rehabilitation. That is the theory that part of what punishment does is to make the person better. That is, we teach that person why it was wrong and this and that. And the answer to that is we simply haven't done that because we've not been willing to commit the resources to it. That's a resource question. We have just not been able to do it. And it has not been a serious part of American criminal justice since the 50s. Everybody will talk about it. All the textbooks will say this is a purpose of punishment. But we the statistics simply do not show that people who come out of prison are less likely to commit a crime than when they went in. It shows that they're more likely than when they went in.
There's one trouble with that, because a lot of people think you're rewarding the criminal then.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Right. Right.
Don't we make more of an effort at rehabilitation depending on what crime is pedophile?
Yes. Yes.
You know, we're making great efforts anyway for rehabilitation without a whole lot of success, honestly.
Well, we may be making the effort. What I'm saying is the criminal justice system isn't the one making that effort. They're, right?
That's well, I don't know. Aren't there sentences, I mean, in the formulaic stuff about for like pedophiles that are I think a classic example almost.
Right.
Inevitably, you know, that, yeah, you can serve your sentence and you're going to get out, but without any kind of effort at rehab.
Right. Yeah, and remember, you're always talking about 50 states. Some states are doing a pretty good job with this, and others are not. Frankly, most are not, but some.
But we don't make rehab efforts at across the board.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But although we use the euphemism corrections.
Mm-hmm. Just corrections. Yeah.
Do you have a sense that we have more crime in this country than most other countries?
More gun crimes.
I've lived in Germany and England.
I have the sense that we do.
I would say yes to those two countries.
Yeah, I have the sense that we do, but you know, that's comparative statistics on crime are so tricky.
Yeah.
Because they sometimes measure more your commitment to law enforcement than they do the amount of crime anyway. Yes, I have the sense that there's more here. And I suspect that part of that is that we're more plural. That if you get countries that are very homogenous, where everybody thinks the same thing, it's like, how many killings and how many even thefts do you see in Holden Village? Well, this is a community that has tremendous shared values. So you don't get it. The more pluralistic you are, I just get the sense that that adds in. Anyway, I need to say turn off the tape. Thank you very much. I'm glad to stay as long as you want.
Thank you.
Just to talk.
Thank you very much.
Could you comment a little bit?